Hello and welcome to this podcast, which covers the discussions at the November 2016 meeting of the International Accounting Standards Board, held in London from the 14th to the 16th of November. My name is Roseanne Shipman and I'm part of the communications team at the IFRS Foundation. I'm joined by Stephen Cooper, ISB member, and Hugh Shields, Executive Technical Director, to talk through the discussions and decisions taken at the November meeting. Before I hand over to Stephen and Hugh, I just want to mention that the views shared in this podcast are those of the participants. They do not necessarily represent those of the ISB. Stephen, one of the topics discussed at the November meeting was insurance contracts. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Roseanne. So the board went through a number of different issues that have arisen as a result of our external testing of the draft of IFRS 17. The staff prepared a testing draft some time ago, and we sent that out to a number of testing participants, 12 from selected around the world, and we have received some testing results from that, which indeed are summarised in papers 2A and 2B to the meeting. Paper 2A summarises the methodology we used, and paper 2B summarises quite extensively the results from that testing process. The testing revealed certain things that the staff felt should be adjusted in the draft, and they brought a series of papers to the board for their consideration with a view to making those amendments. So the adjustments dealt with a number of different areas. Perhaps most importantly was level of aggregation. I think all of the testing participants identified this as an issue from an operational perspective, but also from a conceptual perspective. And the staff brought certain amendments to the board in this particular area. Covers a number of different things. The board decided to retain the existing definition of a portfolio in the draft IFRS 17, but we have made modifications to the way in which contracts are grouped for the purpose of onerous contracts at inception and also for the purpose of allocating CSM and identifying onerous contracts subsequently. For the onerous contracts at inception, I think we decided that it was more to do with drafting and there was greater clarity that was required. Essentially, we retained the decision to identify onerous contracts at inception and then group them separately from other contracts that are not onerous, but it's the way in which that is done and the drafting of that we were perhaps concerned about. The biggest change, though, is in the subsequent grouping of contracts for the purpose of identifying onerous contracts after inception. Previously, we had produced a set of criteria that I think the testing revealed produced a very large number of different units of accounts, and that would particularly have created operational challenges. So now we've tried to simplify that and have required that at the very least there should be two groups of contracts that where there is not a significant risk of them becoming onerous subsequently, and then another group of contracts where there would be a greater risk of them becoming onerous. Companies would be able to group into a greater number than this if that's the way they manage their business. In addition, we said that we would prohibit entities from grouping contracts that are issued in more than 1 year apart. So we have this cohort type approach together with a susceptibility, a resilience to being onerous type approach. And that would produce fewer groups than would have been apparent under the external testing draft. So we think this was a very useful exercise going through the testing, and I think the adjustments that we made here will make it a much more operational process. We also did a simplification on the discount rate. We have decided that an entity should be permitted to use a weighted average discount rate for the purpose of accretion of interest on the contractual service margin and an averaging over a period of 1 year. So that will also further simplify the calculation. We made an adjustment to experience adjustment calculations. Previously, we had said that when an experience adjustment causes a change in an estimate of present value of future cash flows, then the combined effect would be treated as a change in the contractual service margin. As a result of the feedback in the testing, we decided to modify that and treat it as an experience adjustment. And then we will then add some guidance about how to go about the subsequent release of the CSM as a result. So we improved the drafting, but also made a slight change in the decisions in the one situation where the experience adjustment is directly linked to a change in present value of future cash flows. Transition was perhaps the next issue, the most commonly cited issue in the testing after level of aggregation. So paper 2E dealt with modifications to the transition process. The ideal approach to transition is to apply a new standard fully retrospectively. That's what IAS 8 says. But applying that a new insurance contract standard retrospectively would be particularly challenging given the long-term nature of these contracts. So we always recognised that we would need a simplified transition method to make that operational. So we're still saying that ideally retrospective application should be applied, and that should be used unless doing so is impracticable. And we realise that in many cases that will be the case. When it is impracticable, then we are saying that you should be able to choose between either a modified retrospective approach or a fair value approach of transition, where the fair value of the insurance contract would determine the transition contractual service margin. The simplified approach is where we allow certain simplifications with a view to getting as close as possible to a fully retrospective approach, but without perhaps all of the information that's available. So we believe that these three approaches and the way we've structured it will make the transition more operational whilst preserving the useful information at transition about the unrecognised profits. So that was transition. And lastly, the other key area was one of risk mitigation. Now, this particularly relates to the variable fee approach and a situation where we would not have unlocking of the contractual service margin for changes in financial variables. In the testing draft, we had restricted that to one particular situation. Feedback was that that's artificial and that we should be less restrictive, and the board agreed. So we have now permitted an entity that uses a derivative to mitigate financial risk arising from an insurance contract where we're using the variable fee approach to exclude the effect of those changes from financial risk from the contractual service margin when certain specified criteria are met, essentially when those changes are being hedged with the hedging instrument that's reflected in the P&L. So it widens it to all financial risks rather than a subset of financial risks, which is what we had in the draft. And then the last decision was the effective date. And now the board is at the end of the deliberations. We will now, as I said, proceed to producing a final draft. The issuance of the standard is expected to be in the first half of next year. Now we have that visibility about timing. The board took the decision about effective date, and the decision was that we would make it effective from the 1st of January 2021, so periods beginning on or after 1 January 2021. This will allow 3.5 to 4 years after the issuance of IFRS 17 to the mandatory effective date. This, of course, is a very long while considering our normal requirements. It's even longer than some of the transitions that we've had for recently issued more complex standards. But I think this is a reflection of the complexity of insurance and the amount of work that will need to be done by insurers in order to implement the standard. Obviously, the amount of work will vary according to jurisdictions and their current accounting, but we believe this is a fair balance between permitting that lengthy transition period, but at the same time trying to get the improved accounting available to investors as quickly as possible. So that was the last decision about the effective date.
Thank you, Steve. Hugh, do you want to talk about the other topics in the meeting?
Yes, certainly, Roseanne. The board continued its discussion of comments on the exposure draft of the materiality practice statement, which is one of the important projects within the disclosure initiative. And it's worth noting that this discussion almost completes the board's discussions of the materiality practice statement. In the December meeting, the board is likely to conclude those discussions. Well, firstly, the board considered guidance on the application of materiality to errors. And in particular, the board decided to suggest that entities apply the materiality process, which had been set out in the previous October meeting, to assess whether an error is in fact material. The board also decided to clarify that the assessment of the materiality of a cumulative error should be based on conditions existing when the financial statements for the period are authorised for issue. On the other hand, the board decided to avoid providing guidance on how to correct a material cumulative error and also to remove guidance from the practice statement implying that an error is always material if it is made intentionally to achieve a particular presentation or result. The board then considered a paper on covenants and the impact of covenants on the application of materiality, and in particular decided to include in the practice statement specific guidance on how to assess the materiality of information about the existence and the terms of a covenant or a covenant breach. The board then moved on to stewardship and decided to confirm that in assessing materiality of information, an entity should consider whether that information is needed to assess stewardship. The next paper considered the application of materiality in the context of recognition and measurement. And here the board decided to include guidance on the application of materiality in the context of recognition and measurement throughout the practice statement rather than within a specific separate section. In addition on this topic, the board decided to retain in the practice statement examples of the application of materiality, both in relation to recognition and measurement, as well as to disclosure. The board also considered a paper on the possible application of the statement to the IFRS for SMEs standard and decided that the practice statement is not intended to apply to such entities. And finally on this topic, the board considered the status and form of the guidance and decided that the statement would be issued as an IFRS practice statement, in other words, as non-mandatory guidance, which reflects most of the comments or many of the comments received from constituents. The board also had a discussion of the conceptual framework, and this continues its discussions in relation to comments received on the exposure draft. In particular, in this meeting, the board focused its attentions on the proposed liability definition and supporting concepts. And in the first paper here, the board focused on the so-called no practical ability to avoid criterion. And the board here tentatively decided that, as has been proposed already in the exposure draft, that the concept supporting the liability definition should specify that the entity must have no practical ability to avoid transferring an economic resource. The board also decided to refine the concepts on the meaning of no practical ability to avoid, noting that the factors considered would depend on the type of transaction under consideration, and also that it would never be sufficient that the management of the entity intends to make the transfer or merely that the transfer is probable. The board also decided to add no further comments on the meaning of the no practical ability to void criterion, and this is consistent with what had been proposed in the exposure draft. Then in relation to other topics, in relation to supporting concepts and the liability definition, the board considered the term and the meaning of the term as a result of past events. The board decided to make some refinements to the wordings here and also to include clarification that the enactment of a law or some other similar enforcement mechanism is not in itself sufficient to give an entity a present obligation. Then in other topics which are relevant to this area, the board decided that the definitions of an asset and a liability should include both the term present and the phrase as a result of past events. Also, that the concept supporting the liability definition should not require a present claim against the entity by another party. And also that the revised conceptual framework should not contain concepts that specifically address non-reciprocal transactions. And finally, in relation to the conceptual framework, the board considered a paper on the effects of proposed changes to the conceptual framework on preparers, but no decisions were made by the board at this meeting. The board then had a consideration of the primary financial statements project, and this session was very much in the nature of education. The board discussed the results of initial research, including outreach with investors to help define the scope of the primary financial statements project. No tentative decisions were made. However, as we have previously noted in earlier podcasts, this is one of the very most important projects emerging from our recent agenda consultation. And in the December meeting, the board will be making some, or is intended to make some, decisions about the scope of this project. And then finally, I'll say a few words about the board's further discussions on financial instruments with the characteristics of equity. And here the board considered the so-called putables exception. This is that a financial instrument which meets the definition of a liability is nonetheless treated as equity if it has certain features and meets certain conditions specified in IAS 32. Now here the board noted that one of the objectives of this project is to reinforce the underlying rationale of the distinction between liabilities and equity in IAS 32, but it is not to perform a fundamental review or overhaul of this standard. The board also noted that currently it is not aware of any particular issues with the application of the exception that is set out in the standard, and observed that applying the gamma approach to instruments that meet the exception might address some, but not necessarily all, of the previous concerns which led to the exception. And on this basis, the board decided to include in the discussion paper, in the future discussion paper, a discussion of this matter. And with that, I'll conclude.
Great. Thank you, Hugh and Steve. Before we finish, I just want to remind you that the official summary of the November board meeting, called ISB Update, can be found on the IFRS Foundation's website, www.ifrs.org. This contains further information on other topics that were also discussed at the meeting. The next ISB meeting starts on the 12th of December. Thank you for listening.